The Guardian.
Welcome to Media Talk. I'm Matt Wells. In this week's podcast, Losing Their Virginity is the new name for Virgin Radio, just absolute rubbish. Plus, we remember the man behind some of the biggest British TV comedy hits and the star of a few of his own, Geoffrey Perkins.
Our apologies for an earlier announcement. It should have read that a number of enemy soldiers had defected in a field and not what Martin Brown would have.
We'll knock up against the glass ceiling as Selena Scott takes Five to task for age discrimination. And loudmouth talk show hosts who can't stop spouting their vile opinions. No, I'm not talking about me. We investigate the art of American talk radio at the Republican convention in Minnesota.
If you asked me to give you two words that made talk radio the popular refuge of conservatives in the United States, those two words would be Rush Limbaugh.
This is Media Talk from The Guardian. I'm joined by two of our very own big mouths, media consultant Paul Robinson, Guardian media correspondent Owen Gibson. Hello to you both. Hello, Paul. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
You know a bit about talk radio, don't you?
Well, I ran it in the UK for 3 years.
You did, yes. Well, we'll come to that in a bit. Owen, how's the week been for you?
I'm very well, digesting this most surreal week in British football since last one. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I have nothing to say about that, I'm afraid. So we'll just move on to things that I know a bit more about, shall we? We'll return, as I said, to talk radio later, but we'll start with a new name for an old sound.
New name is Absolute Radio. There you go. We're going to become Absolute Radio.
Virgin Radio, soon to be called Absolute Radio.
That's Christine O'Connell on the Virgin Breakfast Show announcing his station's new name earlier this week. It's changing its name because the Times Group, which owns the Times of India, has bought the station, but not the name that's always been associated with it. So Absolute Radio is the new name. Paul, what do you make of it? Is it a good choice?
Well, what they've done is really buy a national AM network and a London FM network. They're really starting from scratch. And Absolute's name's totally fine, but they could have called it Orange or Wells or Gibson or anything. You know, they're going to have to invest massively in marketing.
Because nobody knows it.
No, because Absolute means absolutely nothing.
Apart from a vodka brand, you know, which I've already heard people confuse it with.
And maybe that wouldn't be a bad way to go, because at least there's some values associated with that. I mean, clearly, what they're talking is sort of sensible, but Virgin Radio's never really been a huge star in the radio business. Even when Chris Evans was there, he only had 2% of the national audience. So to sort of move Virgin Radio from where it is now, 2.4 million listeners to 5 million listeners, seems to me like a huge, huge struggle.
Oh, and why couldn't they continue with the Virgin name?
Well, there's two reasons, really. I mean, one, they say they wanted to give it up because the terms of the license were quite constrictive, that they couldn't expand into online, into live events, into other things they might want to do.
That's complete bollocks. why is it bollocks?
Well, because they could.
Well, the other reason was that they... Was it not that they basically kind of
couldn't afford it?
That is the real reason. Because if you look at a station like this, it's 1.4% market share. If you look at where commercial radio revenue is, they're going to take about 15 million a year in top line revenue. There is no way you can spend 8 million licensing a brand with a 15 million top line revenue. They couldn't afford it.
Okay. So why Virgin? Why is Virgin? Now, Paul, you mentioned this. They've never been a star, Owen, in the radio firmament. Why has it never really sort of worked, you think?
I think two reasons. One, again, goes back to investment, doesn't it? I mean, I don't think they spent hardly a penny on marketing. You know, their last big signing was Christian O'Connell 2.5 years ago. No one outside London knew who he was. They didn't spend any money telling anyone who it was. As a listener, there's always been a slight sort of disconnect between kind of what it wants to be and what it sounds like. And, you know, you switch it on and you're more like you'll hear sort of Queen's greatest hits on rotation, and you go in and talk to them and they think they're quite a sort of thrusting, you know, important part of the British music industry and bringing in kind of mainstream credible acts to the nation. And I think, you know, the two things have never quite knitted together, and the listeners just haven't come in big enough numbers, have they?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean Virgin's done nothing really that local commercial radio hasn't done. So why would you listen to Virgin Radio outside London on AM when you've got a fairly good local commercial station on FM playing very similar music? And secondly, it's not done what Radio 1's done. You know, Radio 1's done something different, but Virgin hasn't got the attributes of Radio 1. It hasn't got the coolness, the new music, the new bands, the DJs. So it's sort of stuck, as Owen was saying, sort of in a no man's land with no real USP.
So, Owen, what do the new guys plan?
They say they've got plenty of money from Times of India Group, who sound very ambitious and want to use this as a bridgehead into Europe and into other radio stations. And the other thing is they're boxed in by their licence, of course. You know, they have to be a national rock and pop station. They can't reinvent the wheel here. But they say that they're going to try and make it a bit more credible. They're going to try and make more explicit the link between Absolute and good music, if you like. So there'll be a broader range of tracks that make more of the live music. I just don't hear that any of that is going to be enough to kind of shift the dial into, as Paul says, to double the listenership.
I mean, look, Clive Dickens and Don O'Driscoll are good operators. I know them both. I've worked with them both. I gave Clive his first job. They're both good operators. They'll be doing all the right, sensible things that Owen says. I just think even doing that, it's going to be a real struggle to move the dial.
And the other thing, of course, is that with the name, you can see the headlines now. Absolute failure, absolute cock-up, absolute fiasco. It's not going to be good if it goes on Radar Day, is it? All right, listen, let's leave that there. The changes continue at Virgin over the next month, don't they? The comments have been streaming into our blog, mostly unappreciative of Christian O'Connell, as we said. You can suggest what you do with Virgin, no sniggering at the back, at blogs.guardian.co.uk/organgrinder. Now, there was sad news at the end of last week with the death of the comedy producer Geoffrey Perkins in an accident on Marylebone High Street in London. Came as a huge shock. Many people in TV had seen him only days before at the Edinburgh TV Festival. He was 55. Perkins was one of the most respected names in British TV comedy, responsible for the seminal radio series The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the inexplicable Mornington Crescent game in I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue. He moved on to a hugely successful career in TV, rising to become head of comedy at the BBC in 1995. Recently, he'd been working for Tiger Aspect Productions, and his latest programme, Harry and Paul, starring Harry Enfield and Paul Whitehouse, is due to start on the BBC this week. The comedy producer John Plowman knew Perkins for decades. Their careers developed in parallel, really, and he joined me on the line from the BBC, and I asked him to outline Geoffrey Perkins' contribution to British TV comedy.
Well, it's huge. I'm just sitting here with 5 pages of stuff that was Geoffrey's career, and it's extraordinary. If you start most recently and work backwards, he's Benidorm, you know, finally ITV got a comedy hit, and then you move through all the kind of modern iconic stuff. I mean, you know, Catherine Tate and Happiness and all that stuff with Paul and Harry and Two Pints and on and on and on it goes, and right back to, you know, Norbert Smith and Spitting Image and Father Ted. Not to mention radio, which gets us to Hitchhikers, which is just a seminal piece of work.
What did he have? What qualities did he have that allowed him to, I don't know, spot the hits or nurture the hits and spot the talent?
He realised that you can't do comedy in an atmosphere or anything other than ease and charm and fun, and he had that in boatloads, and he brought out therefore the best comedy and the best fun in other people. But the other thing that I think he was absolutely meticulous. You know, he would go through scripts with a pencil, he'd tick every point at which he thought there might be a laugh, he'd lose a few if he thought there were too many on the page. You know, he was a meticulous script editor.
The answer to everything.
Yes.
Life, the universe, and everything.
Yes.
Is.
Yes.
Is.
Yes.
42.
You mentioned Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You said it was a seminal work. What made it seminal, and what was Geoffrey's contribution?
Well, funny enough, I think it's the same thing. I mean, I think I was actually sharing a flat with him in Shepherd's Bush, which was rather ghastly. I mean, not sharing a flat with him, but living in Shepherd's... Anyway, let's not go there. It was the same thing. It was not being content with, we'll stand a guy in front of a mic and he'll read the stuff and we'll put a few silly noises on it and it'll work. It was layers and layers and layers of sound. Brilliantly done. It's a cliche that the radio thing, the bitches were much better on radio. He tried to sell it to BBC Records to put out as a double album. And they said, oh, no, we don't think comedy works. No, I'm not sure about that. And Geoffrey didn't kind of give up. He took it to Charisma, and Charisma had a huge hit with it.
It is most gratifying that your enthusiasm for our planet continues unabated. And so we would like to assure you that the guided missiles currently converging with your ship are part of a special service we extend to all of our most enthusiastic clients. And the fully armed nuclear warheads are, of course, merely a courtesy detail. We look forward to your custom in future lives.
It's interesting that he, after this very successful career as a producer, and he was very involved, as you say, he went on to become an executive, didn't he, at the BBC? How did he take to that?
Don't overestimate the role of the executive in comedy. Actually, what that means is just producing. I think he continued to do that meticulous thing on programmes, even programmes that he wasn't, as it were, the notional producer of. He was a wonderful encourager of writers, encourager of producers. And I think Geoffrey was frustrated by the system. It's tricky doing comedy in a great big organisation because comedy is about two or three people reading a script and laughing. And then hopefully you get it good and it's about 200 or 300 and then 2 or 3 million. And I think there's something about great big organisations that means that they tend to be run by serious people who are a bit scared of comedy and think either that it's a bit frivolous or that it's something that they don't quite understand or know how to contain. And I think Geoffrey got as frustrated by that as every person who's ever encountered it. And so in the end, you know, what he went back to was producing, and I've sort of done the same.
I'd like you just to spell the name of your native country. So, Maria, let's start with you.
Italia.
Yes, very close. It actually ends in a Y. Pierre.
France.
Yes, I'm afraid there's no such letter as And finally, Klaus.
Dutschland.
Not even one correct letter there, so...
He also dabbled a bit in front of the camera, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He did. He fronted a kind of literary quiz for Channel 4 in its relatively early days. And he was in, obviously, he was in KYTV, which began as Radioactive. And, you know, I first met him at university when he was in Oxford Reviews quite a lot of the time. And he was very good at it.
And what would you say that his legacy was, looking at the state of sort of British sitcom just now? How do you say the landscape looks without him?
Personally, I mean, I think the landscape is bleak because he was a great figure. He was a great and relatively unassuming figure. You know, some figures feel like their job is to do the job and tell everybody else that they're doing it. And Geoffrey didn't really have that. It stands a chance of being a less inventive place.
John Plowman there. You can read a tribute from Tiger Aspect's Peter Bennett Jones at blogs.guardian.co.uk/organgrinder. Now, let's take a look at some of the other stories that Media Guardian has been looking at this week. Let's start with this story about Selena Scott. Extraordinary story. Channel 5, it seems, had lined her up stand-in for Natasha Kaplinsky on 5 News. She's on maternity leave. Then, apparently, it went back on the deal in favour of Isla Trocare. Scott, who's 57, is now bringing a claim of age discrimination. And that all happened in the same week that the Equalities Commission said there were fewer women in senior positions in British industry, including editors of national newspapers, than last year. Now, you remember we talked about this issue in our Edinburgh podcast, and I challenged Emily Bell on this. So when I bumped into her in the corridor earlier, I had to eat some humble pie.
I think it's really interesting, and in some ways I would like to see this one play out, you know, up to and including, you know, court, because I think that the issue of, you know, ageism, particularly around on-screen women, is something which is so manifestly visible, brackets invisible, there are none. And yet in an ageing population, and particularly with women who have been in work all their lives, this idea that somehow at sort of 50 you no longer have a sustainable career is completely outrageous.
And it seems to be something that is a particularly British thing.
I thought it's very interesting, actually. You know, in America, there are plenty of, you know, the Barbara Walters, etc. There are plenty of kind of women who are over 40, over 50, who are on air. It's not a, and that's a culture, actually, again, where there has been a great deal of, I wouldn't call it sort of political correctness, but there's been a great deal of sort of patrolling in terms of quotas and diversity, etc., etc. And it would be completely unacceptable in America to say we can't have a newsreader who is over 45 or whatever. It does reflect the fact that there are a lot of senior men who run and programme British television.
Now, this podcast, of course, is a living illustration of the problem being made up entirely of men, at least in the studio this week. So I'm not sure whether we have the authority to discuss this issue, Owen. But, I mean, the Selina Scott thing, it seems to be so blatant, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you only have to look at the screen to see that this problem has existed for decades and continues to. But, yeah, I mean, the Selina Scott example does really sort of crystallise it, doesn't it? As Emily says, I think it will be interesting to see it play out to its logical conclusion, although I fear, as with most of these cases, that it won't actually reach the court steps.
I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, Channel 5 are desperately crunching the numbers as we speak and working out how much they can get away with. Paul, is it, as Emily says, an issue because TV is, despite some, you know, notable advances, still pretty much run by middle-aged men? Or is it a wider problem in society, do you think?
I'm not sure it's that. I think it's more about competition. I think There's more a perception that even in a news broadcast, you want someone who is attractive. Yeah. And an older woman perceived to be less attractive than a younger woman.
I do understand this. They've even gone to the trouble of taking pictures of Selina Scott, Channel 5 had done, and she looks great in them.
I think she looks fantastic. I mean, really, the criterion should be, is she still up to it in terms of her presentation skills? Is she still a good journalist? Can she deliver? I mean, as long as you're not, you know, so ugly that your face is going to put you off the stories and all you're going to see is some ugly mug. Yeah. It seems to me that having a woman of mature years is actually totally fine and gives authority to news.
And the thing that I really don't understand, Owen, is that if they had hired her, it would have made a right old splash in the papers, whereas, you know, nobody's heard of Isla Trecaire. You know,
absolutely. For a channel that's supposed to be trying to keep its publicity head above water, if you like, and trying to remind viewers that it exists, it would have been a fantastic signing, you know. And now it's getting publicity for all the wrong reasons, you know. But also, going back to Paul's point, I wonder if it's something about the way we look at newsreaders in this country, you know. They have always been judged on their presentation and what they look like rather than their journalistic
and why
abilities.
Does it seem to be a peculiarly British thing? Because if you go to America, you'd expect the TV to be full of dolly birds. It actually isn't.
I don't know. I have no idea. Mm. I cannot understand it, because You could argue it's even more competitive in America than it is here. So the competition argument sort of falls away in America. And, you know, you have to say, as you say, Barbara Walters is really odd, isn't she? I mean, she really is. You know, she's well beyond Selina Scott's age. So I don't know. I mean, I miss Maureen Stewart too.
Yeah.
I thought she was fabulous.
Crazy. Yeah. We lay down the gauntlet to British TV bosses. Other news.
Chris Shaw, if you're listening.
Chris Shaw. You see, the thing is, it was Chris Shaw, I think, and it's been written in the stories. Chris Shaw had done the deal, and it was the new director of programmes, Ben Gale, who put the kibosh on it, apparently.
Oh, really? What would Dawn say about that, I wonder?
I wonder if they want to try and get this all wrapped up before she starts, won't they?
Yes, absolutely.
Anyway, in other news, the Daily Mirror is cutting jobs. Trinity Mirror has been cutting jobs all over the place, regionally and now, Owen, nationally. What's going on here?
That's right. I mean, the latest place where the axe is going to fall at the Mirror is at the flagship title. And, you know, you speak to people there and there's a real fear that, you know, I mean, to say they're going the way of the Express does seem like it's quite alarmist, but you know, the people who work there think that that's the way they're headed. You know, when you've got the Daily Mirror getting rid of its foreign editor, It's, you know, it's fairly cataclysmic stuff, and it just feel like the huge swathes of cuts that have been going on in its regional operation and at some of its sort of less visible titles, The People, for example, are finally kind of hitting the flagship brand, if you like. And I think, you know, it's genuinely worrying, not only for the people who work in there, but for Fleet Street generally.
And the Telegraph going full colour and the Times to raise their cover price. Now, does that mean that the age-old, you know, Murdoch price war stuff thing is over now, and that newspaper owners are realising that you have to charge a proper price?
It does feel like we're entering a new age particularly in the sort of quality newspaper wars, if you like. I mean, they're all very heavily getting into subscription, and for a long time there's been a debate about whether or not subscription will work in this country, and that will be played out. Telegraph has relaunched, celebrating with a new crossword. You know,
I haven't noticed.
That was his front page.
I can buy a copy now.
Absolutely.
What a draw.
Is
exactly.
It more or less difficult?
I think it's more difficult.
Okay.
But anyway, the point is, I think that they're very much moving into being premium products now and being only one part of the newspaper alongside the website. It's almost an acceptance, I think, that the kind of headline sales will keep dwindling. And as we've talked about for a long time, how do you use it to A, make as much money for as long as you can, and B, to promote your broader offering on the web and all the rest of it.
Part of the same story, or in the same ballpark, is this news that the Time Out boss, Tony Elliott, is considering ending the print, or going to a free print version of Time Out and sticking all the listings on the net. Does that seem like a
sensible... Well, he's been mulling for some time, I think, what to do about this conundrum of the fact that, obviously, a lot of his listings information is now free on the internet. You've got all these, particularly in London, the daily free sheets that give out a lot of listings information. And actually, I think Time Out's hung on very admirably, particularly in the last sort of 2 or 3 years since it's had a new editor, to try and find a new place in the world. And I think it's genuinely a very good magazine. But Tony's obviously looking to the future and looking to the fact we've now all got in our pocket for the first time mobile devices that can genuinely access this information on the move. Mm. And I think he's got to be looking at new models and new ways of trying to make money. And the logical thing to do, I think, is to perhaps go free and try and make your money on the web.
And finally, neither the BBC nor ITV will be showing highlights of England's World Cup qualifiers. This is the first time this has happened. Now, there's some row with Setanta over this, is it?
Basically, Setanta have got the exclusive live rights. Traditionally, they would then sell on the highlights to either BBC or ITV, which would show them later the same evening. Setanta are holding on to them. ITV and BBC say they're charging too much, that they want to hold on to the exclusive rights. Conversely, Setanta say ITV and BBC are not offering them enough money, and they're basically engaged in emotional blackmail, trying to whip up a campaign to get them to give them away. So, I mean, in one sense, it's just, you know, your classic kind of football rights standoff, but it does mean, I think, that a lot of people will be turning on their televisions expecting to see the highlights, and they're just not going to be there.
The question is, will the matches be worth watching, though?
I can exclusively reveal almost certainly not.
Okay. Thanks, Owen. Keep up to speed with breaking media news at mediaguardian.co.uk.
Media Talk with Matt Wells on guardian.co.uk.
Now, I've been keeping erstwhile Media Talk producer Ben Green busy in the United States. This week, he's been amongst the right-wingers at the Republican convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, which I think has been a bit of a culture shock for the poor lad, being used to the liberal confines of the Guardian audio department. So, in an effort to expand his horizons, he decided to look up a few shock jocks.
My name is J.D. Hayworth. I'm a former member of the United States Congress representing Arizona, and I'm afternoon talk show host at KFYI Phoenix.
Now, talk radio is a relatively new concept in the UK. It's been running here in the US for many, many years. Why is it so right-wing, though?
Well, it became the first audience. We go back and take a look at it, and even in the pre-Reagan era, when there was this antiquated and misnamed piece of law, the so-called Fairness Doctrine, even then, talk radio has had a popularity in the United States. In fact, I like to call it the world's first truly interactive medium, because a telephone line and a microphone and an on-air signal, and there you go. But it has been around quite a while. I think that conservatives found a home in talk radio, quite frankly, post-Reagan, because of the prominence of Rush Limbaugh. I can't find an apt sporting analogy for my British cousins, but let me just say this. Rush Limbaugh established the commercial viability of talk radio, really resurrected the AM band in the United States, and local stations have found that it is highly profitable, and the conservative audience goes there. It's just, I think it's... just a combination of terms, but if you asked me to give you two words that made talk radio the popular refuge of conservatives in the United States, those two words would be Rush Limbaugh.
Why is John McCain going to be great for this country?
Well, it's not so much that John McCain is going to be great for this country. John, in terms of military preparedness, is someone who I've known for years. I don't agree with him on every issue, but I think he fulfills the role, will fulfill the role of Commander-in-Chief infinitely better than would Barack Obama. And elections are always a situation where no one is perfect, but I think that the stewardship of McCain as president will be light years ahead of that of Barack Obama.
What makes a great talk radio host?
More than a propensity for verbosity, there must be an ability to listen to callers. The real test of leadership is not necessarily loquaciousness behind the microphone. It is the ability to listen and know one's audience. And indeed, I would argue that leadership in a constitutional republic where one runs for and serves in public office is predicated on one's ability to listen. And that's also true in debate.
and I had the privilege of debating before the Oxford Union last November, and it's the closest sensation an American will have to being prime minister, standing at the box between the benches. But as we know, debate is prefaced not only by the ability to talk, but perhaps more importantly, by the ability to listen.
I should say the guys in the studio are all making terrible faces there. But hey, the thing is, guys like that are really big in America, aren't they? Why don't they go down that kind of style, Paul? Why doesn't that go down so well in the UK?
Well, I think it's partly about wanting to get calls. You know, I mean, the whole point about talk radio is, as a format, you've basically got the microphone and the presenter, and it's a hell of a long time to fill 3 or 4 hours without any callers. So you need to stimulate callers. And saying extreme right-wing things is far more likely to get calls than being liberal and being generally, you know, accommodating and more sort of willing to listen to alternative arguments. So it's partially about that. I think it's also a cultural thing and of the political makeup of the US compared to the UK. When I joined talk radio as MD in 1996. It had been on air since 1995 with a shock jock format with people like Terry Christian and Caesar the Geezer. And it was doing okay in listening terms, but the big, big thing was, A, you run into the regulator, because here you've got to be impartial. And look what happened to James Whale when he said, vote for Boris Johnson. You could do that in the US, you can't do that here. And secondly, advertisers hate it. And the reason I moved it away from shock jocks was because there were no advertisers and therefore there was potentially no business.
Is there any sort of future for this kind of stuff in Britain, do you think?
Well, as on television, as with radio, over here you've got the big difference of the BBC. And, you know, it seems to me that Radio 5 Live is increasingly a talk radio station in all but name in some key parts of the day. And that's obviously a big difficulty. But over at TalkSport, at some point they took the decision that no, you couldn't make a business out of general talk radio and that sport was the way they were going to go. So.
All right. Well, thanks for that. I should say that Gareth McLean is on sabbatical for a month.
Shame.
Well, I was going to say...
Who signed that off?
News which may be greeted with delight or despair, depending on your point of view. We'll figure out a way of replacing him next time. Before we go, I do want to bring up this extraordinary interview that Michael Wolff did with Rupert Murdoch with Vanity Fair,
wasn't it? It's a fantastic article, you know, and the big news that comes out of it is not that Murdoch brokered the truce between Barack Obama and the Fox Network or that he wants to buy the New York Times, but it is in fact that he dyes his hair aubergine and not only that, he refused to have it done in the salon but does it himself in the bathroom.
No way.
Because he thinks that otherwise someone would notice.
I don't think I would notice that he was dying his hair.
Why aubergine?
Well, I don't know. I guess that's the colour on the packet, isn't it? And maybe that's
we do need Gareth's bitchy comments on that. We really do.
Yeah, we do. We'll wait for that next time. Thank you. Well, thank you very much to Owen for that revelation. Owen Gibson and Paul Robinson, thanks to you. Media Talk is produced by Scott Corley. I'm Matt Wells. There'll be more Media Talk soon. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.